This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Now this takes us into our next session with our next panel, internment during World War I in Australia, with our curator John O'Lineen in conversation with Nadine Helmy, author of The Enemy at Home, German Internees in World War I Australia.
Okay, so my name's John O'Lean. I was one of the curators who worked on the Homefront exhibition, and it's my pleasure to welcome and introduce Nadine Helmy, theater director and curator from Sydney.
Hello.
Nadine was one of the curators responsible for the Enemy at Home exhibition that was on at the Sydney Museum in 2011.
2011, yes.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking today about German internment, or internment in general, during World War I in Australia, and that goes beyond just German internees, of course, because it related to all the different Axis powers at that time. So I think I think we're just going to have a conversation here, and I think I'd like to start by asking Nadine, your background is in theater as well as curatorial work. How did you get to be interested in this area of internment in World War I?
Yes. I was always interested in history. I studied German literature, so I've got a kind of academic background anyway. And I've written actually plays about Australian history, but colonial history, you know, so I was very familiar with historical research. Now, as a theatre person in Australia, you always look for other interesting jobs, you have to. And one of my colleagues who also cooperated in theatrical productions was Dr. Gerhard Fischer, who a now emerited professor of German studies at the University of New South Wales. Gerhard Fischer was an expert in everything that concerned the German community and in particular the internment First World War period. He has written a brilliant book called Enemy Aliens, which contains basically all you need to know. And he asked me, he was asked by the Parks and Wildlife Services at Trial Bay, which had been one of the internment camps during the First World War. He was asked to write a report, an in-depth report about this period while it was used as German internment camp, in order to facilitate the interpretation, because at Trial Bay Jail, the remains of Trial Bay Jail, the whole area is quite a tourist area, and yet, lo and behold, it turned out that while the Germans were there, it turned out to be the most interesting time of the jail, because the Germans transformed that place a little bit. So they wanted to know more about it. And I agreed to be the field assistant, so I went there, went through the archives, and stumbled upon a couple of black and white photos from the period. And here comes probably my artistic background into play, because I thought the photos that I saw from the internment were just brilliant. And I was curious who made them. Staff at the jail thought it was a prisoner with a jerry-built camera, but I could see these photos were done by a professional with good equipment. So I did a little bit of detective work and tracked down, found out that the photos had made their way back to Germany after the photographer was deported. It turned out it was a young Bavarian photographer who somehow, on an Australia trip, ended up interned, stayed 5 years in internment camp, and ran a photo business, photographing everything, and the internees could buy the photos. And I discovered a collection of 1,000 photos back in Dorfen, close to Munich. And so I could then determine exactly when was the theater built, where was it built. I could document just about everything in really brilliant photos. This guy, Paul Dubotsky, was a very talented young photographer. In fact, he had been asked to board a expedition as a photographer towards the South Pacific. More, we don't know. How he ended up in Australia, we don't know, but because he was so talented. And so I became a curator and an exhibition which was actually really very well received, mainly because nobody knew that there had been internment camps in Australia in the First World War. Everybody knows about the Second World War. Nobody, virtually nobody, knew about the First World War. Now, Second World War is known and, of course, was traumatic for everybody involved. However, the internment in the First World War was, I think, more important because it meant the disappearance of a previously visible, successful, and largely loyal community, the German community, that contributed a lot to this country, really a lot. And because of the internment, which was only the, how do you call it, the top part of the iceberg, you know, there was persecution, there was harassment, there were, you know, all kinds of regulation and, you know, born from that anti-German paranoia, which got this community to go completely underground and low-key change their names. We know that anyway, German place names were anglicized. The schools were closed, churches, congregations, newspapers. So, and the Germans themselves told their kids, "Don't talk German." The kids were told partly they were of. I spoke to people who were told they were Swiss, Belgian, Dutch, everything. So they. After the First World War, there was no German community anymore, as a community, as a social, cultural identity. And I think that is important. It's to know that. It's important to know that because actually a lot of Australians do have German ancestry. And in the 19th century, the German community was, the Germans were the largest non-speaking ethnic groups. There were no Italians or any of those southern European migrants. The Germans were the ones who also were deliberately brought to Australia by agents. Agents went to... from Queensland also, you know, but generally Australian agents went to Germany to specifically bring over migrants for agriculture, for their agricultural, you know, skills and knowledge. The whole wine industry is completely unthinkable without German imports, so to say. And also, of course, the tradespeople, and they usually were very successful. So this internment, which is literally not known in Australia, and is, I think, of a bigger importance than what happened in the Second World War. And I think it should be known because that is the history of Australians. That is quite a part of their heritage. And, you know, coming from Germany, I mean, we just want to know what happened before in our country. I come from a city that is was founded by Romans, and so I know the Roman history. So I think it's important.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because there's almost a state-based reasoning behind this, isn't there, Nadeem? Because the Hughes government, there seemed to be a two-pronged approach to this persecution in a way of the Germanic society within Australia. Firstly, to undermine that society, its cultural integrity, And secondly, the economic power of Germany, the perceived economic power of Germany in Australia. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, definitely. In particular, the economic power. That was really something that was the pet hate of Billy Hughes. And it was actually largely really due to his particular obsession, actually, with, eradicating any connection between Germany and Australia in order to divert all trade and everything from Germany to the empire. Hughes was, himself Welsh, and he had this idea of Germany infiltrating everything and wanting to take the power of the British Empire. Now, of course, Germany had just been in existence since 1871 and, in fact, all of a sudden became a superpower. It's a bit like China now, but Hughes really thought as an extension of the British Empire. Whereas Australia's interest could have been to have a blossoming trade with Germany and have, in fact, 30% of all exports of Australia went to Germany, the whole wool and so on. Mm-hmm. So, and Hughes didn't want any connections there between Germany and any economic activity here or by Germans or by Germans with Australians. So what he did was there was the Trading with the Enemy Act, which basically destroyed any German-Australian business connections and also meant that anybody with German or even with German descent had to wind up their business. And there was a myriad of restrictions. Basically, it destroyed any German or German-related business. And the internment helped because the first people to be targeted from the end of 1914, the first people who had been residing in Australia were the business people. Business leaders of the German community, so they were removed. Later on, also Australia was the place where every German business people from the colonies, from the former German colonies, but also British colonies, were brought. So also those businesses lost their, were finished. Yeah.
So maybe we could step back to that time, and maybe you could talk a little bit for us about the attitude in Australia. It seems very strange looking back in retrospect that the government could, in some way, legally take these people and intern them, but Hughes didn't seem to have any problem pushing that through.
No, because he provided, the legislative groundwork was provided through the October War Precautions Act from October 1914. On August 10, all people with German descent had been called upon to go to their local police office and register as enemy aliens. And they had to give a lot of personal details. And then the policeman would, upon this, make a report where he would judge on his impressions whether this particular person might be not dangerous or illoyal or might have to be examined by the military authorities. And in the War Precautions Act, which was amended a lot of times, and the definition of enemy alien extended, just provided for the fact that if you were found, to be, or if the impression arose that you might be not loyal, then you could be interned. and you didn't have any recourse to judiciary process, legal counsel, nothing. So and of course also the Austrians, with Germans and people of Austrian descent, which of course at the time included Hungarians, Serbs, Croats, yes. Dalmatians, Istrians, you know, so they eventually all ended up in the internment camps. But for these people, it was a total shock to go from respected citizens with all rights to basically being treated like a criminal, or actually worse, because they couldn't even have a legal counsel. Mm-hmm. And a big role played in this context played dobbing in from neighbors, you know? So if you were dobbed in, the neighbor would say, I've heard them sing a song celebrating the Kaiser. You know, and you know, if the policeman who held the reporting card would then judge that as not good, then you know you could find yourself in the internment camp, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And you would not get out for 5 years, mostly, and then deported.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get to that in a second. Mm. I think that's very interesting. You know, so many of these early internees.
Sorry, can we just? We could run already.
Oh, well,
some
photos
of the pictures of the internment
please,
camps.
Yeah, hopefully. Oh.
Oh, okay. Just sort of while I speak, you know, these are photos of. This is can you keep your question?
Yes.
the guy on top in the white shirt is Paul Dubotsky. You can see he put a white shirt on, put himself on top. He was a little bit vain, I think, but he is very,
typical,
you know, it's a gorgeous guy and just really an artist. So he, that shows him in Torrance Island, one of the first camps. And I will run photos that he took from Holdsworthy and Trial Bay. There are photos also from Berrima, another camp, which are part of his collection, but they were not taken by him. Anyway, they are wonderful photos, and I will explain a little bit more in a minute. But you can have a look. Otherwise, I'm worried we can't see them.
Yes, please. I'd love to see.
So where do I press on?
I think it should be.
Kill some lights.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we could put the light down a bit.
Oh, okay. Which one do I have to press? Okay.
There we go.
That's him in his cell. Now, always with a cigarette.
Nadine, that's great that you had Torrance Island up there, first of all, because maybe we could talk a little bit through the progression of camps,
yeah.
Starting with the regional camps and then moving into the centralized systems, and especially the problems that the Germans experienced early on in those regional camps.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yes, so declaration of war, 4th of August. In Australian ports were about 29 German ships. And I mean, Hughes, of course, had a point. Germany was booming. Germany was starting to be a big competition for Britain with their ships and their float and their commercial float. So they had discovered that Australia wasn't really serviced well enough. So there were a lot of German ships actually going, you know, to the South Pacific, to Australia, New Guinea, etc. So there were 29 ships in port, and the sailors of those ships were immediately, of course, detained, and improvised camps for them erected. These camps, these provisional camps, very primitive, you know, with tents and sort of in bushland mostly, existed in all military districts in Rottnest Island, Western Australia, Torrance Island, South Australia, Bruny Island, Tasmania, Enoggera, Brisbane. What else do we have? We have, of course, New South Wales. In New South Wales, the former training ground or a training ground of the military in Liverpool was used. So the first inhabitants, so to say, were the ship's crews, but very quickly then interned and enemy aliens from Australia were interned. Now, the ship's crews, of course, for them it was normal. There was a war, you know, that they would not be sent back to Germany. But as I said, the former Australian residents, and some of them born in Australia, some of them not even speaking German, they were really absolutely shocked that they had, you know, to leave their families and were marched into the internment camps. So these internment camps were very quickly filling up, and because they were so primitive and there was not much regulation, not much control, in these camps, in particular Torrens Island, on Torrens Island, there was physical abuse by the guards. Also what would amount to torture, I guess, you know, people were kept in outside in rain for 24 hours or more. And so those problems of not being able to cope in these different camps led the military authorities to decide that all the regional camps would be closed and only three camps in New South Wales be established or maintained in the case of Liverpool. You know, the Liverpool camp was enlarged and became the largest camp, holding up to 6,000 people. And in the end, and then two privileged camps were established for the privileged people. One in Trial Bay, which I mentioned. Trial Bay, like Berrimah, which was in the Southern Highlands, Trial Bay was in close to Kempsey. Those were disused jails, which were then used as internment camps. Trial Bay was used for those merchant planters, wealthy German business people that were plucked from the colonies, from New Guinea, which was a German colony, Hong Kong, Singapore, Tsingtao was also a German dominion. So they came to Trial Bay, about 580 of them, and Berrimah. To Berrimah were sent the German captains and officers of the German ships. And I'll show you photos of these camps. The latter ones, all this happened by in 1915. So until then, everybody was in the regional camps. Those were closed. And then people were shifted or interned in either Liverpool for the kind of sort of normal classes, and that meant mostly the ex-members of the German-Australian community. Trial Bay for the merchants and planters from the colonies, and Berrimah for the ship's captains and officers. And those privileged camps were in fact very privileged because the inmates were allowed during the day to wander in a little radius around their camps. The poor people in Liverpool had to always remain behind the barbed wire and be under very, very primitive conditions in permanent dust and sand. So they definitely suffered much more than those privileged Germans, so to say, who could, in Trial Bay, have a bath in the ocean, and in Berrimah use the Winch Caribbee River for their entertainment. So I just quickly show Holsworthy. So that was quite late in the picture, and you can see all those barracks. People were... Shall I continue to...
Yeah, sure, yeah? Sure.
People were squeezed in very little cubicles. Mind you, they were built by the Germans. You know, there were lots of German ship's carpenters who said, there's no place to live. There were only a couple of tents. So they designed actually those, that's the watchtower, designed those barracks which had only three walls and a tarpaulin flap. So it was very cold in winter, very hot in summer. Pests. It was really, to be there for 5 years.
And Nadine, I found it very interesting that within these camps, whether it was Holsworthy or Trial Bay or Berrima, a very Germanic system of organization developed, in that there were businesses, there was cultural activities. Maybe could you tell us a little bit about that transition from the militaristic kind of overview of the camps to this internal organization that occurred, and then the development of that in 1916 onwards?
Yes, so the beginning was really, really tough, with accommodation, food, everything. But then, after a while, all participating nations in this war realized that actually they would not walk away after 4 months as the victor. Everybody thought that, 4 months of war, and then we win, and that's it. No, so everybody, the military, the guards, and the internees realized we are here for who knows how long. So slowly the German internees started to ask to be able to do the internal management of the camp. And they did that, very efficiently. They had, as Germans do, committees. And it was all, in fact, I'll show you photos of that. Very strict committees. They had elections. And in fact, in all the camps, but possibly mostly so in this one. So this was the beginning, that these were the sanitary conditions. They all sat on a piece of wood. I don't think that improved much, but a lot of the other things improved. That was the Kaiser Wilhelm Street. The whole camp really was turned over the years, in particular from 1916, when the commandant changed, and who was a little bit more lenient and let the Germans do that internal management. From there, the whole thing developed like into a mini German town with a lot of shops, restaurants, clubs, really like a theater orchestra. You'll see photos of that. And they called it our town. That was the Kaiser Wilhelmstraße. Then there was a new town. There was an old town. They had a gym. After a while, they built a gym. Everything you find in every small German town. That was the kitchen facilities. Very primitive in the beginning, but then what the Germans also did was they established kitchen gardens, where they had, I had a garden in Sydney. You can plant so much the whole year. So they had, they then could supplement all their food in these gardens. They had that in Berrima and in Trial Bay. In Berrima, I researched, that the internees planted things that even the good people of Berrima had never fancied to plant, like watermelons and, sort of more exotic plants. That was the beginning. That was, one of the cafes, but that very quickly evolved. That's the Café Barbed Wire. Yeah, they had a good sense of humor. They had to. Oh, okay, sorry. A billiard club. Can you see all those beautiful? They must be the sailors, good-looking blokes. That was the canteen. The canteen was like a supermarket in the shop. The internees got things from Sydney, then sold them again, and with the money they made, they provided infrastructure, recreational infrastructure, so built the theatre, orchestra, and also recreational sports facilities. So these were one of the shops, Seppel's Bakery. That's the butcher, of course, and this was the bakery of the military, but of course they had German bakers, so the bread, I'm sure, would have been better than before. They also, can I say the nastiest thing I sometimes think? if you wouldn't have sort of like like disappear the German community, maybe public transport would function these days. Anyway, I won't say anything more. Okay, they also had exhibitions, you know, the models of all kinds. People really, they knew in order to survive, you know, this ordeal and the boredom and so on and the paralysis in the camps, they had to busy themselves. So they had schools, they had, they taught languages, they taught painting, and all those, all kinds of things, also vocational courses. You could become a pastry cook. Whoever could teach something taught it. And there's the painting school. And this was the Volkshochschule, that's an evening college. This was the gym. And this is the kind of things they did. They had festivals, big festivals. So they knew they had to practice, the exercise their body and their mind. Voila, voila, voila. That was the theater, so I go through quickly. This was actually in the middle of that. You have the story of Overbeck.
Yes.
That's Overbeck.
There's Hansi right there.
Yeah. You know, when he wasn't sort of doing drama, he collected ants. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they had elaborate theater programs, which apparently were better than what you could see in Australia at the time. A visitor said that. That was, of course, and the urge was so big to get on stage that, because there were no females, yeah? So after a while, the guy said, okay, you know, what has to be done has to be done. So, yeah, and this was Walter Himmelmann, you know, when you take the wig away, he had actually was completely bald. He was one of the favorite female actresses, you know, and apparently got love letters. There were printing presses, there was design. This was a cabaret called, devised by the internees, called OU, My German Concentration Camp. Very funny. Odu, Mein GCC. More acting photos. Look at these amazing photos. I just the other day got an email by the grandson of this bloke who ran the theater. Oh, this, you have to see this. I mean, when I saw that, look at this. You know, they had talented people. Anybody who had any talents would do it. And the theaters had to produce a new show basically every 1 or 2 weeks because then, you know, the audience was exhausted. So, very beautiful. Berrimah, that is the Berrimah camp, the previous jail. The Vinge Caribbe River, and these are the well-dressed, privileged, probably upper-class German captains. This is a bridge the Germans built. And they built these little huts. That's the Emden Hut, meticulous, and along the river. And that's where they spent their day. So they didn't have it all that bad. You know, then I think there was a flooding, so they just shifted it. Look at this, you know, very...
I heard that the residents of Berrimah actually got quite upset because the Germans had created almost a holiday camp along the Vinge Caribbe. And to the point where the commandant actually told the Germans that they weren't allowed to go there on the weekends.
That's
so the
right.
residents actually came and used the facilities on the weekends.
Yes, it was very much a little Disneyland.
Yeah.
That's right. And not only that, they did how do you call that? Anyway, kind of festivals on the water, mm-hmm. and had these miniature tour ships. I think this might have been a replica of a Kaiser's yacht or so. And yes, I think the Berrimah people probably. They also had the most money because they still got money from Germany. So there you go. You know, that was the Kaiser's
shot. That's the Kaiser's shot, yes.
Yes, that's right. You know, the local people couldn't trust their eyes what was happening there with those Huns. Trial Bay. Also, those were really privileged because they could go outside. Here, this is a photo where you can see here, you know, those buildings, that big building next to the Dole track, that's the theater. Called the German Theater Trial Bay. That was a roll call. These were the cells. None of the people, none of the internees got provided with any furniture or anything. They got a storm lamp and a little bit or and something to dress, some dungaree clothes.
Dungarees.
The rest the internees had to provide for themselves, so they did. That was a cell. And can you see the little houses? Yeah, that was the beach cafe they built. And can you see the little houses dotted around, yeah, around the jail? They built those. One of them, this one here, that white one here, was the so-called Berlitz School. There you could learn languages, you know? And there was a naval...
Chinese, Malay, French, Italian, Spanish.
Yeah. Whoever, you know, they had all those colonial people, you know, whoever could teach something. And you could learn naval engineering. And if you made the exam, that was acknowledged in Germany later on. That was the Strandcafé later. It was extended and renovated, as you do in Australia. So this is a proud owner of a hut. In front of his hut. Now, that hut is in a northern German style. Carter, you know, it must be a northern German guy. Another one. And here you can see a beautiful photos of the trades. That's a tailor. And can I just once say, see how Dubotsky used the light? I really love that, because obviously I didn't have lamps, so he had to wait until the light would shine through. Cobblers. This was the laundry Edelweiss, or the other one, there were two. No, it might have been the laundry Diligence, called Diligence. Barbers, that's Edelweiss. Laundry, that was a laundry, in case you're wondering what that is. Jeweler, that was the pharmacy. Of course, they had newspapers. Which have very interesting articles. That was the World on Monday editors. More. And the censors. These were the censors who they could write, I've forgotten now, you know, a postcard per week with 125 words, but of course it was censored, so you couldn't really write anything of real information, but otherwise you'd get it back with a stamp, censored. That was the commandant, I don't know which one, of Trial Bay. That was the canteen of Trial Bay, also very civilized. And you could also, the Trial Bay internees, of course, were, you know, had still quite a lot of money and could buy what they wanted from Sydney. That's my personal favorite. That was the kitchen of Trial Bay. I think that's a wonderful shot. Also there, he probably waited until that light hit these pots. More butchers. And these were the elections in Trial Bay. Elections, you know, for the president of the Trial Bay internment camp. This was the hospital. And on the right, you see... Dr. Max Hertz, he was an example of the naturalized Australian being interned. Max Hertz had come to Australia early in 1900, married an Australian woman. He was the first orthopedic surgeon in Australia, and he could do operations that couldn't be done before. In Australia. That was enough to attract him the jealousy of the medical association, and they tried their very best to first intern him, which they succeeded, and then they tried to get rid of him. But a petition of his patients made that in the end they had to keep him here.
But he wasn't allowed to register with the medical association even after the war.
Oh, okay, yes, that'd be right. He had his practice, personal practice, in Rushcutters Bay, but he did continue to operate on club feet and things like this, an operation that could not be done in Australia, you know, because the art, the skill had not been taught. Yeah, Max Herz, very civilized person, I think a typical example of the German Jewish bourgeoisie, very educated. He ran the theater in Trial Bay, in addition to being the doctor, and also played the cello. This is when they built the theater. This is Dubotsky standing at the stage entrance of the theater, in Trial Bay, wig maker. A lot of theaters here would envy the theater in Trial Bay. I did, in any case, you know, with all the facilities. Kurt Wiese, later on, do you know Ping and the story of Ping? He is the illustrator. Blokes getting ready to play. Das Weiße Rössel, the White Horse Inn, very famous orchestra. Let me get quickly to... this is... Do I have time to explain? Or more?
I think very quickly we should talk about the deportation and then we'll go to questions.
Yeah. Here it is, the deportation. So all this lasted until 1818. In mid-18, Trial Bay was... you know, people were shifted from Trial Bay because there was a rumor that a German cruiser had come to free the internees. They went to Holsworthy, and only in 1919 the Australian authorities started a process of what they called repatriation, which meant, though, for many people, deportation. And 6,150 people were deported and, of course, basically prevented from staying in Australia or coming back to Australia. This was particularly hard for people who had resided in Australia and had to leave their families.
And I think it's important, Nadine, to point out that 4,500 of those were naturalized Australians.
700 were naturalized Australians, but 4,500 had been residents of Australia. Not all had been naturalized because it was a bit complicated. If you were naturalized, you had to give up your German nationality. But then you only had, you know, you had not a very solid citizenship because you didn't have the British. You weren't a British subject, you know. So it was, I think a couple of people were reluctant. And anyway, like it is today, you know, people have no passport. You lived here for 50 years. People thought that's enough for me to qualify as resident. And so there were 4,500, and amongst them were 700 who were naturalized, and 70 who were born in Australia, there were people who didn't speak German. But on the whole, one can say that there was, you know, people tried to also show their loyalty. You know, so this was a total shock, the deportation for the previous residents of Australia a total shock for them, and for their families a tragedy, because they they were never seen again. So that's the deportation. That's the ship Kursk went on May, and it transported people from Trial Bay.
Now, I think maybe we should try and get some questions in quickly, Nadine, otherwise we're going to run out of time. Okay.
But I might suggest that we break for lunch and you get a tax down with full questions.
Yes, any questions, please approach Nadine at lunchtime.
Yeah, I'll be around. Very happy. If you're interested, I brought a book. This is my book, so if anybody would like to read up on it.
Highly recommended.
Because, it also contains a slightly different interpretation, quite a different interpretation of the whole pre-war, situation. So very interesting, I think. It is called...
The Enemy at Home.
The Enemy at Home, German Internees in World War I Australia. And I have yet to find it on shelves. I think there's a little bit of a tendency to not necessarily put it in front of people's nose. And, sorry, I have to say this. Initially, you know, when it came out, 2011, the sales agent of my publisher told me that the war memorial initially didn't want to stock it because it tarnishes Australia's reputation. Well, just saying that, but the only thing is, it's just the truth. But important is not what happened exactly, because, I mean, Germans did much, much worse later. But I think people need to know what happened in their country.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm
available. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.